Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we preview the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra's final classics concert of the season. Now, they have several pops performances still to come, but tomorrow evening marks the end of the classic season with an ambitious program, including Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 4, which will also feature soprano Sarah Coburn, Edward Elgar's In the South Overture, or Alassio, as it's often called, and John Adams' The Chairman Dances. The performance takes place tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Chapman Music Hall. I'm joined today by the conductor for the concert, Daniel Heggie, who is the principal guest conductor for the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra. He's currently the music director for the Wichita Symphony Orchestra and a frequent guest each season with the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra as he previews the program for tomorrow evening. Daniel Heggie, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. It's always a pleasure to have you with us.
Great to be here, Rich.
I have to tell you, this program that you're going to be doing Saturday night, it's a big program. I mean, when you think about doing just a Mahler symphony, that's enough for most orchestras. That's an evening.
Right, that could be an evening. Now, in this particular case, Mahler's fourth symphony is actually one of his shortest, clocking in at just under an hour. So people might think, what? That's short? Like under an hour? I think, hey, that's a couple, you know, Seinfeld episodes or something or whatever you watch. So I don't think it's that. That's very long, actually. And I think that the Mahler symphony has so much variety within it. It's really considered his most Mozartian symphony that he wrote. It doesn't have any low brass, no trombones or tuba. It does have some percussion, but it's only for color. It has a somewhat augmented woodwind section. And of course, the string section is standard. But the style of it feels very Mozartian, very classical, even though it's a very, very romantic
work.
Have you
heard the melodies? You would not think of Mozart, though.
No, you wouldn't really think of Mozart because he uses a harmony of late romanticism. But when you hear the phrase structures and things like that, it almost feels lighter. And of course, no, it's not like Mozart. But if you had to say of all of his symphonies, this one would most resemble that of Mozart.
Mahler's symphonies are sort of a window into what he was experiencing for the most part when he's writing them. What was going on in his life?
Well, this happened right around the turn of the century. I mean, he incorporated a song that he had written, a freestanding song, Das himmlische Leben, The Heavenly Life, that was freestanding in 1892, and he uses that as the fourth movement of this. So that was actually composed about 8 years before he wrote the rest of the symphony. And I think, you know, this was a time when he was always challenging his own beliefs. I mean, he was a real thinker, and he read voraciously, and, you know, he challenged his own ideas. And, of course, we know that as a Jewish person in Vienna, it was a little bit difficult, but he was quite famous as a conductor. So then he got baptized as a Christian, as a Catholic, and was that done for political reasons? Was that really because he's believing? Some of these things we don't really know for sure. But we do see that he always seems to be challenging himself, you know, with different revelations, and he wants to write about it. And the thing about this piece, I think, is in the fourth movement that we talked about, Das himmlische Leben, the heavenly life, where he has a singer, and we're going to have Sarah Coburn here singing the soprano part in that fourth movement. And that's from the viewpoint of a child in heaven. And it has a very naive, very innocent, very sweet look at what that might be like, and it's just gorgeous music.
Now, this was a bit of a innovation within the form of the symphony. Now, you have choral symphonies going back to Beethoven, but the idea of having a single singer as a part of a symphony, that was a little different.
That is unusual. You don't always see that, where it's really just like a song, you know, and it comes from the collection of poems, Des Knaben Wunderhorn. So first four symphonies that he wrote are really considered like Wunderhorn symphonies, because he uses either the text or uses tunes that he had set Des Knaben Wunderhorn to. And so, yeah, you're right. Having a solo singer just kind of as part of the texture of a symphony is unusual. But it seems like he had a great plan, almost working backwards, as it were, because he had that freestanding orchestral song already, and then thought, how am I going to get there? And you can hear the transformation, actually, even from the very beginning of the symphony, how he was able to compose the first movement, second movement, and third movement that led in a kind of logical storytelling way to get to the fourth movement. I think that's really fascinating, because you can actually hear some of the motivic detail from the first, second, and third, and getting there. And of course, the second movement has this kind of almost diabolical, almost dance macabre kind of feel to it, because Rosica is going to be playing on a violin that we call scordatura, which means she's tuned it a whole step up from where it is. And it makes a very brash and devilish kind of sound. And that's going to create a different timbre. So you go through that kind of devilish sound of the second movement, you go to the sublime third movement, which really tells a story. And then at the end of the third movement, it's like it forms a little transformation, almost like a gateway into heaven, into another sphere. And then the fourth movement, we're there. We're there in heaven.
This song is sort of reveals sort of like a childlike view of an angel. Is that right?
Yes, it is. And even complete with talking about, oh, there'll be animals, like the oxes will be there and the birds. And then you actually hear that sound from the orchestra. So he actually writes it into the instruments that it sounds like this is what an ox sounds like here. And sometimes it's moving very fast, very fast music, and sometimes it's very slow and very pastoral. So he covers all the different kind of moods that a child would be talking about, and he captures that so well.
You have a special voice to sing this, and Sarah Coburn, who's this beautiful soprano voice, and I assume that's what you need for this particular symphony.
You really do. You actually need someone with a good range, good vocal range, because it starts off, it can be quite low, but it goes up quite high, and someone who can really be good at telling a story, really at expressing the text in a way that goes with the music well, but really talks to the audience. So I'm looking forward to working with her.
Well, let's hear a bit of the Mahler fourth movement of the Symphony Number 4. Here is a recording of the Mahler, which will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Saturday evening at 7:30. Music by Gustav Mahler. My guest today is Daniel Heggie, the principal guest conductor for the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra, who's leading the symphony in this. It's a very ambitious program, because anytime you do a Mahler symphony, there's just a lot of rehearsal time needed, because Mahler doesn't move at a sort of linear pace like most other symphonists. It's fast. It's moving slow. It's either moving forward, moving back all the time.
That's right. There's a sense of rubato through the entire symphony, and through really all of his symphonies. There's always this tempo that has to be very, very flexible. And he has so many indications in the score that he expects us to follow. He was a conductor. He was most famous as a conductor during his day. And so he knew the tendencies for other conductors to take his music, and for the players. And so he would write lots of notes, like verbal notes, like be careful not to cover this instrument. Be careful that this comes through. Do not drag here and do not rush here. Don't hurry. He says all of these things, like right when you're thinking, hey, maybe the tempo should pick up here. Don't hurry. He writes it in. Oh, okay. So he knows what our tendencies might be at certain things. And so he's basically guiding you through. And what I find interesting is that even going back to Beethoven had access to a metronome, so a machine that can actually measure tempo. Now, Mahler lives much later than Beethoven. Of course, everyone has a metronome by Mahler's time. And yet he doesn't use metronome markings. He does mark tempo markings, but he only says them verbally. So he says fast, but not too fast. A little faster, more flowing here. So he's much more into communicating the idea, the mood, which is much something that's much more like Wagner. And I think that maybe he gets that from that, you know, he conducted so much. And so I think he was trusting the interpreter to feel what that music required in terms of the tempo. So it's up to us to determine what that is. And of course, when you're looking at the form, the structure of the piece, you're looking at like areas that say, okay, well, this section of the form is like this. So when that theme comes back, that tempo, we have to reach that tempo again. But sometimes it's overlapped with slower tempos, so you have to figure out how you're going to negotiate that. But yes, it does require a lot of rehearsal time, and there's so many details in the music. You know, some person has a breath mark, someone has a forte piano, while someone just has piano on that. So they might think, oh, well, I should play forte there too. Maybe I have a misprint. It's like, no, you have to follow exactly what he says. He's fascinating because he's really interested in color, in the color of the sound. So you might have, let's say, the violas and the clarinets playing unison in thirds. So they're playing the same line, but you might have the clarinet starting forte with a diminuendo, and you might have the violas starting piano, crescendo to forte. And you hear this beautiful change of color. It's almost like kaleidoscope, you know. So I would hope that the audience can really pick up on those kind of things happening and the sudden shifts of mood that Mahler is going after. Because sometimes you're just this really sublime, like everything's perfect, and all of a sudden it's like, whoa, a chill goes down your spine because this something else is kind of intervened into the texture. So he's very good at creating these worlds that sort of collide, that overlap, that shift abruptly. And I think it's just fascinating. But yes, it does take time to prepare that.
But you were also talking about the idea that with no tempo markings, a conductor has a lot of freedom. But of course, you have 100 years of performance tradition too.
You do. And of course, it's wise to consult that, because we do have links, you know, through Bruno Walter, who was there at his side and heard Mahler conducting those. And then recorded a lot of them. So we have links to people who were alive during Mahler's time and making those connections. So it's wise to consult those. At the same time, I think you have to really figure out there are multiple ways you could still look at the music and say, this is what this music requires. And I think he was trusting in the same way that Wagner has a treatise on conducting. And he talks about how music, based on the kind of music it is, you have to determine the tempo based on what the phrase needs, based on what the flow and the quickness of the harmonic rhythm, how quickly does the harmony change, and what does the melody require in order to breathe properly. And he talks about how he heard Beethoven's Ninth over and over, and he said he didn't like the piece. And then he heard a conductor conduct it with what he thought was the proper tempo, and he said it all made sense to him. And he said, it's finding that, which is so critical. And I think Mahler follows in his footsteps, because he does write tempo markings. He just doesn't write metronome markings. That's the difference. So, it is open to different considerations, and different conductors do it different ways.
Oh. Well, of course, a Mahler symphony on a program means that's usually where the lion's share of the rehearsal time goes to. But you have two other big pieces that are going to require a lot of rehearsal time. I assume you had to have a plan going into this set of performance.
Yes, I really did. We're doing John Adams' The Chairman Dances, and we're also playing Edward Elgar in the South, or called Alasio. That's a tone poem. And that's about a 20-minute piece, the Elgar, and the John Adams is about a 12, 13-minute piece. So, those pieces are difficult, and they require time as well. So I really have to go in and pinpoint the areas that I think we really need to spend the time on. And then I can trust the intuition of the players, because they're incredible. I mean, they're amazing musicians, and it's a treat to work with them, because they learn quickly, and they come prepared, and they're ready to make music. And so it's always a joy for me to go to rehearsals with them.
But that Elgar piece, you know, it's been in the repertoire for a long time, but I don't think it's played that much in the United States. It's mainly, you see it a lot in the UK, obviously. It's a British composer. It's a great piece.
It's a great piece. And I think I don't know, you know, sometimes there are just question marks about it, about why it's not played more. You know, we just scratch our head because if you listen to it, you just say, oh my word, I love this piece. It's just so lush and it goes right out there. You know, I mentioned earlier when we were talking, when you start the piece, it's almost like you're pulling the ripcord on a motor and it just explodes with life. And it seems to owe a lot to Richard Strauss because it seems very much like a Strauss stone poem. It has that kind of richness to it and the lush quality and the big brass moments and the very tender, sweet moments in there as well. But it's a phenomenal piece, and I'm really happy we're doing it.
Maybe it's the length of it, because it's too long for what you would normally put as an overture. It's too short for the, you know, like a symphony or a Strauss tone poem at the end of a program.
Yeah, it can have that length is like, where exactly do you put it? I think we have it at the perfect place in the program here, because it'll be second, because we start with the Chairman Dances, which is a great starter, and then we do the Lacio in the south of Elgar, and that makes a very nice compact first half, and it kind of sets the table, as it were, for the second half for the Mahler, which is, like I said, a shorter Mahler symphony.
And this Edward Elgar piece was basically a vacation piece.
It was, yeah. He was with his family down in the town of Alassio, actually in Italy, and they were at the Riviera, and he was walking around taking walks with his children, and he was thinking about perhaps composing something, and he said, in a flash, it just came to him, this theme, which you hear right at the very beginning, that kind of explodes to life, and he just sat down and penned it. And I think, yes, but there's so much development in it. I mean, what a craftsman. I have much more admiration for him after really studying this work and rehearsing it. It's just a brilliant piece of music. And, you know, as opposed to a lot of the Strauss tone poems, which end quietly, this one ends really big and triumphantly. I mean, Till Eulenspiegel of Strauss ends big. But a lot of them are really, really quiet at the end. You know, if you think of, Death and Transfiguration and all those. So, but this ends with a very heroic kind of feel. It almost feels a little bit like his Heldenleben, in a sense, because it's in E flat. It has a heroic theme to it. But I know Elgar, I don't think he had that kind of personality, really.
No, is this a new piece for you?
Yeah, it is new. I knew of it because when I was at the Baltimore Symphony, David Zinman conducted it. And so I was covering it. And so I learned it back then about maybe 20 years ago. So I had a score of it, and I had marked it up, and I kind of knew it from watching the rehearsals and being prepared to conduct it should I have to step in. So when the programming committee came to me and said, we want to do in the South, I was really excited. I said, this is my chance to actually get to conduct it. So I really restudied it and got it really ready before coming here.
When you come back to a score like that after so many years, what was your initial impressions on revisiting it?
Well, first of all, a lot of it came right back to me. I looked at it and I was just thinking, okay. And I thought, oh, that's where the theme is. You know, I mean, there was just kind of new discoveries if you really look at it very closely, because you approach a score a little bit differently when you know you're going to be rehearsing it and trying to bring everything out and which voices have to be more, which have to be less, and the kind of articulation you want here and there. So when you decide the shape of it, you have to make more of those decisions. So I got to dig in on a much deeper level.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the Elgar in the South. This is a recording, London Philharmonic Orchestra with Leonard Slatkin playing. Let's just hear the opening of the In the South.
Oh, great.
Music by Edward Elgar to be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra tomorrow evening at 7:30 in the Chapman Music Hall, in a program which will include that Elgar in the South, along with Mahler Symphony No. 4 with Sarah Coburn singing, and John Adams, the chairman, dances. My guest today is Daniel Heggie, the principal guest conductor for the Tulsa Symphony. And I mentioned this Elgar, it's like a big tome poem. You have a big Mahler Symphony, and you have this overture, the John Adams, the chairman, dances, which is... It's a tough piece. It requires a lot of rhythmic precision and just absolute precision from the orchestra.
You're right. First of all, John Adams is probably the most important American composer we have. He's being commissioned all over the world, and the Berlin Philharmonic plays his music all over Europe, in China. This is from this piece that we're playing, The Chairman Dances, is actually from an opera he wrote called Nixon in China, which is very interesting opera. I haven't seen the whole thing, but it's fascinating because it actually is about Nixon's visit.
And it was the first opera based on sort of contemporary events. And then you saw a whole spate of operas about contemporary subjects being performed.
That's right. Written. It's a real political event that he writes about. And when we talk about The Chairman Dances, he's talking about Chairman Mao, of course. And he's talking about Chairman Mao actually dancing. So it's not a set of dances when we say The Chairman Dances, but it's actually the chairman is dancing. If you can think of it that way, The Chairman Dances. But what you said is really correct. This is written around 1987. So a lot of people might think, uh-oh, modern music. But I tell you, this music is just cool. It's just really interesting. Right from the beginning, we hear this even eighth notes that just go, and it's like another world that you're kind of entering into. And like you said, everyone has to be so precise because you have this motor rhythm that's going on all the time. It has this incredible energy, and then the orchestra, different parts of the orchestra enter in at different times, and have to come in very syncopated, very rhythmic, very precise ways throughout. And then there are a few tempo changes as well that changes mood. For example, in the middle, there's a section where it's almost ghostly and very, very odd, almost like you're you have an imagination cloud over here somewhere. And then all of a sudden it starts to lock back into this tempo, but it starts to move faster and faster and faster. So it has a beautiful shape to it. And I actually have a preface from the score that talks about the chairman dances. So if I can just read that, it says, to describe the piece, Madam Mao, who's Chairman Mao's wife, has gatecrashed the presidential banquet. She is first seen standing where she is most in the way of the waiters. After a few minutes, she brings out a box of paper lanterns and hangs them around the hall, then strips down to a cheongsam, skin tight from the neck to ankle and slit up to the hip. She signals to the orchestra to play and begins dancing by herself. Now, Chairman Mao is becoming excited, so he steps down from his portrait on the wall, and they begin to foxtrot together. They are back in Yan'an, dancing to the gramophone. So if we know that Mao is stepping down from his portrait, we know this is something that's imagined. It does feel like a memory, especially when you get to the end, because we've heard all this huge climax in the orchestra. It gets very loud at times, and then it starts to wind down. And you actually hear the music slowing down at the very end. And it becomes very sparse in terms of the instruments that are playing. It ends quietly. And that's, I think it's very romantic. It's a very beautiful kind of scene that you can imagine, because it's like they're dancing together and the gramophone just sort of slows down and stops. And that's the end. It's a great starter to this program because it adds a completely different flavor that we don't get for the rest of the concert.
But when you think of everything that's happened over, say, the last 25 years, you go to any film and you can hear this piece and other pieces by John Adams and Philip Glass's influences in film scores, and mm-hmm. and you hear it in commercials, you hear it everywhere.
Yeah.
This continuing ostinato mm-hmm. and this harmonic language that evolves through that ostinato, it's just become ubiquitous. And mm-hmm. I just remember what a controversial thing it would have been to play this piece like 20 years ago.
Right when it came hot off the press.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think people are more used to these sounds now. And I think what's fascinating in this piece, you know, as you mentioned with the ostinato, is that he starts over time, it starts to almost metamorphose, because it starts to, you the tempo in one way, and then it starts to move, even while keeping that same motor rhythm, it starts to create a different world. So he can sort of shift the mood over time, even while that ostinato continues underneath the music. It's fascinating music, and I had a number of players coming up to me before we started rehearsing and said, this piece is so cool. It's just so interesting. And I think it's just a delight for the ear to hear something that's so fresh sounding like this piece. before we get into the more kind of traditional textures of the Elgar and even the Mahler.
You brought up a really interesting point about the connections between Mahler and this particular piece, because like the Mahler, where you may be sitting next to the next person in your section and you're playing forte and he's playing piano, and all of a sudden that changes, same thing happens in this piece where everything's dovetailing.
Yes, it is, and it's overlapping, and some people are playing something completely different, like one person's syncopation where they have to just kind of pop in for a moment and then pop back out is different than the neighbor they might have right next to them. Nothing is quite aligned together throughout the orchestra, so there are all these different commentaries that people make separately, and then they come, then they go away, then they come back, and so there are a lot of different things going on at one time in that piece.
Well, let's hear a little example of that. Here's an excerpt from John Adams, the chairman, dances with the Baltimore Symphony, and your old conductor, David Zinman.
Oh, great.
Music by John Adams, The Chairman Dances, which will be start out actually the performance by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra in their final classics concert of the season. That's tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Chapman Music Hall, along with the Mahler, the Elgar, and John Adams, The Chairman Dances. Really interesting program. What has the rehearsal process been like for you this week?
It's been great. It's been fantastic. The orchestra is just there. They're ready to go. They're excited about this music. They like all three of the pieces. I mean, how can you not like the Mahler? And then, like I said, so many people come and say, wow, excited we're doing the John Adams piece. And the Elgar is a wonderful discovery for many of them. And so I think all the three pieces, it's just exciting to really get to do. A lot of the players are so experienced. They've played a lot of the staples in the repertoire. So to get to do a Mahler that isn't done that much. I mean, Mahler in general isn't done that often. So to get to do it, it's just something that's really scrumptious for orchestra players to get to play. Same with the Adams and the Elgar. They're just not done that much. So to get them all together is just like a huge treat, I think.
Well, it sounds like it's going well, and we look forward to a great concert Saturday night.
Yes, I'm looking forward to.
Daniel, it's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks, Rich.
Daniel Heggie is the principal guest conductor for the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra. He leads the Tulsa Symphony in their final classics concert of the season tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Chapman Music Hall, featuring a program including Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 4, which will feature soprano Sarah Coburn, Edward Elgar's In the South, and John Adams' The Chairman Dances. For information on the concert, visit tulsasymphony.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.